Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 9:47 p.m. and that is Paris time. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I do apologize for the late posting of the audio yesterday, but unfortunately, the internet connection that I have access to right now in my hotel, it's not normally what you get in a Marriott, so they don't have an upgrade option. So I'm kind of dealing with hotspotting with my phone. So sometimes you're going to see that the Bloomberg screens take a little while to load, and it does take a long time to upload those videos into Vimeo. And unfortunately, last night I was exhausted, so I just didn't have the staying power to wait for the video to upload because it was taking forever. Well, when we look at the Baltic Dirty Index, this is the conventional way of looking at the price of oil tankers, and it's breaking out. It's not just breaking out over the last decade, and there's nothing trendy about this indicator. It tends to go up and down a lot. And even back during the big commodity bull market from the early 2000s up to 2008, it was exceptionally cyclical, going on these huge swings both up and down. But we're now taking out the highs that were put in between 2003 and 2008. And there was only one time during that period when the price of a tanker exceeded those levels. So this is really significant. It means that the cost of shipping oil around the world is leaping higher. The EU is talking about a price cap on Russian oil. But then the question, of course, is going to be, how is that going to be enforced? And in fact, will they be able to enforce it at all? Are they going to penalize the friendly countries that are, in fact, doing everything they can to export as much oil and gas to the EU as possible? And then it raises some very important questions for shippers, because what's now starting to happen is a bifurcation in the shipping sector. We've already seen that the supply chain issues that arose during the pandemic, where there was an acute shortage of ships because the demand went through the absolute roof, and there was problems finding crews for ships because of the speed with which the virus was spreading through crews. That led to a massive surge in the price of containers being shipped around the world and months-long queues outside major ports like Los Angeles. Well, that's all a thing of the past, and consumer prices have experienced less upward pressure because the queues at shipping destinations have abated. But now what we're seeing instead is that tanker rates are rising right now, and this is a very small portion of the overall shipping sector. But the big picture, of course, is that Europe is deploying the financial, I guess what we're going to call them, is weapons at its disposal. So they're deploying insurance, and they're not going to allow any major reinsurance company to offer insurance to any tanker that transports Russian oil or gas. Well, historically, old ships would have been sold off, and then they would have been junked because they were often worth more as scrap than they were on the water. And now, what's more likely is that those older ships will see an extended life period servicing the export needs of Russia. But if you can't get insurance for your ship, well, why on earth would you then spend the additional resources to make sure that it is seaworthy? And I think that is going to greatly enhance the potential for a major accident. Now, it does not mean that it's going to happen this year, but probably within the next 5 years, if those older ships aren't properly maintained, then the corrosive elements of the ocean are going to play havoc with those vessels. So What are being sowed in right now are seeds of destruction in future, and the longer this condition lasts for, the more likely it is that there's going to be a major accident on the oil sector at some point in the next few years. And of course, that will be blamed on Russia. But then it's also going to lead to a massive move in terms of the environmental lobby. I took the Eurostar from London to Paris, and there's big signs on the train saying that you saved the equivalent of 13 flights by or that it's 13 times less carbon intensive than taking a flight. So there's certainly a trend towards more environmental awareness. And certainly then there's also this bifurcation as well on the political horizon, where there's people who are still denying climate change, and on the other hand, there are people who are animating and agitating and throwing soup on paintings, saying that we should just stop oil now. Well, you can't stop oil right now, and we might never be able to stop oil. But there's definitely a move underway to try and limit the number of use cases for fossil fuels. So then let's look at the oil price, because oil prices are an inhibition to consumer spending. Of course, cars are more fuel efficient now, and certainly what we have is a global economy that is less oil intensive. But the other side, of course, is that engines tend to be more fuel efficient, but then cars got bigger, and all the added extras and all the toys that have been attached to vehicles that basically has. And then, of course, there's the additional point that people decided to live further away from their major source of work. So engines might be more efficient, but people live further away, and then they engage in lots of additional toys, and not least air conditioning. So oil prices are back at around $83. They had been locked in a very tight range between 90 and 100 for 6 weeks, and that kind of very inert trading doesn't last indefinitely, and now oil prices are at breaking downwards. So this is meaningful, and oil closed close to the lower side of this little range that's been forming for the last week. And I think that there is significant potential here that we're going to see additional downside. So then let's examine, well, where are the potential areas of support? Well, the first is that it might come back down towards 80, and that is representing the upper side of the underlying range and the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And then when we think about that, well, that would really be a convenient area for the bulls if prices were to find support there. But the reality is that the vast majority of people, they tend to think about oil as demand being a steady growth trajectory, and then supply v being variable around that constant. But in a slowing global economic environment, then not only do you have variables in the supply side, but you also have variables in the demand side. And this is what we're seeing right now, that the global economy is slowing. And even though people are talking about recessions in Europe, but I will say that the streets of Paris are very busy. Lots of people out shopping. They've even adopted the Black Friday sales in many of the stores, which is a new phenomenon, but certainly driven by tourism. And in London last week, the restaurants were full. Now, you might say that that is a World Cup phenomenon, and that we're just getting a bump from the World Cup and the party atmosphere around it, and that it won't last. And certainly there's been incredibly bearish sentiment because of the energy crisis. I know that when we got to our hotel, the air conditioning or heating will not work if the door to the balcony is not fully closed. So those kinds of sensors have been introduced to help to limit the or to enhance, I suppose, the energy efficiency of the building. And we're going to see more of those labor saving, more of those energy saving devices being implemented all over the world the longer prices stay high. And of course, we are seeing again another bifurcation where oil prices were often considered to be a barometer for energy. Well, now we are, I think, more aware that oil is really about transportation and natural gas is about heating and cooling. So I think it would be very benign if oil prices were to hold the $80 area, but I just don't think they're going to. I think we're in for another bout of significant volatility because the global economy is slowing down. And then let's just think about how that how the proposed cap on energy prices is supposed to work. The Europeans don't want natural gas trading really above 275 euros. It's at 131 right now, and it is certainly steadying in the region of the 200-day moving average. But it would have a long way to go to get up to 275. So we're really talking about extremis. And there is absolutely no guarantee that prices are going to get up there. So what we might be looking at realistically is a an academic argument around this price cap. And then if prices do get up that high, well, the last thing they're going to be able to do is to penalize the suppliers that they rely on. All of these kinds of well-meaning or dictatorial type of policies tend to get introduced in response to a crisis, almost in a vindictive manner. And we know, and we have seen plenty of examples of vindictive behavior by crowds over the years and decades. And it doesn't generally lead to anything productive. Then this week, we had Germany saying that they're going to penalize the producers of clean energy and that a windfall tax, hoping to garner 130 billion, is going to be imposed on utilities like RWE. So the share is still rising, and that is very much reflective of the fact that they just don't have anywhere else to go when it comes to providing electricity. So the talk about a windfall tax isn't really translating into bearish action either. Now, when we think about this wider slowdown, well, China basically was able to avoid the vast majority of the slowdown in economic activity because, or at least that was true for most of 2020 and 2021. The Chinese economy has slowed down significantly because they've gone in and out of these tight lockdowns for most of the last year. And what I find especially interesting right now is that Xi Jinping is being photographed with an increasingly large number of international leaders without wearing a mask. And that's really a big change in his behavior. And until quite recently, when he went on his first trip abroad, he disappeared for 11 days. So it's reasonable to anticipate that he was in quarantine. Well, he wasn't in quarantine for more than 2 days after going to the ASEAN confab. And there were a number of senior politicians around the world contracted COVID, and not least the chief executive in Hong Kong. So it does look like they are inching towards easing up on some of the restrictions. And what's going on in Foxconn, I think, is especially interesting because people were locked down inside the facility. They had really bad conditions enforced upon them, and they rebelled, and a large number of people left the facility. But we're talking about a workforce of 200,000 in this facility. So when you see news stories talking about several people walking home, the production was still not particularly impacted. What has impacted production over the last 48 hours was all those people were told that the pay that they'd been promised wouldn't be given to them until they signed up on an agreement that they would have to work through the mid-autumn festival holiday. And they've already been locked in, and they're already dealing with hunger and dingy conditions. So there was a bit of a rebellion, and they overwhelmed the riot police. So Honhai position, Precision is back in the region of the lower side of the range. And they're the major manufacturer of iPhones. So this is not a bit a bullish looking chart. And it was in negative territory today, and there's the clear potential that it is going to break on the downside. But then we can also think about, well, what else is Honhai Precision doing? Well, I think the most success, significant when we think about Apple is that Honhai Precision bought Lordstown's factory. And they promised that they would manufacture Lordstown's cars for them in their own factory. So that gave Lordstown a chunk of change. It also allows Honhai Precision to demonstrate that they're capable of making vehicles, because it is very likely that what Apple is going to do in the automotive sector is going to be revolutionary. It's exactly what Giorgio Marchionne was suggesting with Fiat Chrysler about 4 years ago before he retired and subsequently died. His suggestion was that the automotive companies were wasting money by producing the cars themselves, that they should really adopt the kind of OEM model, which is the original manufacturer model, that the semiconductor and the garment sector had deployed. So that does appear to be what Apple intends to do. They have no intention of manufacturing cars themselves. They'd be more than happy to design cars and spend most of their time on the software. So what they're really thinking about is that what Apple can do for cars is bring the iOS software and operating system that everyone is familiar with in an iPhone or an iPad, and then introduce it into a car, and then perhaps make the driving experience easier. Well, that is the bet, and they've plenty of money to throw at this idea, so perhaps they have a better than even chance of succeeding. But of course, what it is also going to do is force companies like Mercedes, Ford, BMW to make a decision as well, that are they going to be able to keep going manufacturing their own vehicles when Apple is securing a better margin? I do believe that is the main reason that these types of companies are now trading at single-digit multiples. And we've certainly seen that companies like Mercedes, sorry, my Bloomberg is acting up here. So I'm going to see if I can just open another window. And I'm not at all sure why it doesn't like me typing like this. But what we can then think about is companies like Mercedes and Ford, those other companies, they're trading on really low valuations. Mercedes has got a PE of 5, yields 8%. Volkswagen announced a new type of car. They said last week that they have developed a new hydrogen fuel cell vehicle that has a range of 1,250 miles. And the share was in negative territory in here today and pulling back from the region of the 200-day moving average. But it's trading on an estimated PE of 4, and it yields 5%. So when we think about the equity markets, there's certainly an argument that there's value out there, and that There's the potential here that some of these companies will do well in an environment where their valuations are low, and that interest rates will eventually start to come down. It'll make cars more attractive. And they're getting plenty of support from governments in terms of the migration towards electric vehicles. And what they're basically doing is they now have an excuse to streamline their manufacturing, to get rid of some of their workers, and to limit the number of suppliers that they have because electric vehicles have fewer parts. And at the same time, boost their margins. But in an environment where there's economic growth slowing, a lot of these companies have already priced in a really bearish environment. So valuations are low. And bear markets can be characterized by a process of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. And that's already occurred in the global automotive sector. So those that are exhibiting relative strength are certainly worth paying attention to. And then I think it's also relevant to keep an eye on Tesla because they were had first mover advantage, and the share went on a spectacular run. So going from what really feels like zero, but it wasn't zero, in 2019, up to a peak of over $400, and now down to 182, that's a really extraordinary move, and the trend is no longer consistent on the upside. But the price is at least steadying now in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So it's still a downtrend, and we might yet see some steadier action. But we're in a situation where Tesla is, I think, experiencing many of the same difficulties that Netflix has. Because one thing about having a Tesla vehicle is that the operating system inside all of them is exactly the same. And the driving experience isn't really all that different. Certainly, some of them have got a bigger cockpit, but they all tend to have a similar drive in terms of the speed of the acceleration, the difficulty with braking. And when we look at what happened with Netflix, they had first mover advantage as well. Then they got every other media company competing with them on the streaming front. Now they are struggling to grow their subscriber numbers. They're talking about doing what every other company is also doing, which is introducing marketing and, or I guess, advertising spend. And this is also, I think, rather important that all of these major technology companies are dealing with slowing growth, and they're all seeking to deploy the same kind of business model that their competitors have done. So on the one hand, you have companies like Microsoft that deployed the subscription business model, and in that regard, they copied Adobe. But now we have Amazon has a subscription, Apple has various subscriptions for the bits and pieces of its services program. Netflix is already a subscription business. Tesla has said that if they ever do succeed in acquiring or developing the autonomous driving technology, then they'll start a taxi service, so it'll be more difficult to buy the vehicles, or you'll have to pay an additional premium for it. So that tells us that subscription business models have really permeated a large part of the technology sector. Well, then we can think about what the other business model is that's been highly successful, and it was social media. So social media and Google's search engine, what they successfully did was to garner advertising spend from large numbers of companies. Now we have Apple has created this walled garden, so any information that comes through the App Store does not go out to the app developers, but stays within Apple, and they're going to sell that information to advertisers. And Netflix is talking about introducing advertising. Amazon did introduce advertising 3 years ago. It's now the fastest growing segment and the third largest at nearly 60 billion. So we have to think, though, that one of the reasons why Netflix collapsed is because the number of potential viewers is finite. Now they have to share. And Disney spent a ton of money to develop its streaming service, and then it collapsed. It's down 50% this year. And now it has Bob Iger back as the CEO. So I do wonder how long it's going to be before he pulls the plug on streaming, because it's exceptionally difficult to make money on it. But I think the bigger question now is what happens with advertising, because the market is finite. It's not like every company can afford to spend an equal amount of money on every advertising venue. They do have to make some value decisions and decide where that money can be best put to use. So Amazon is now looking to benefit from it, so are conventional companies, and of course you have Amazon, Google, and all the other social media companies too. So Meta Platforms is deeply oversold, and I think it's only a matter of time before they pull the plug on the metaverse, or at least virtual reality. And then I think the share will probably rally quite significantly because it is still very oversold. Now, thinking about very oversold markets, it's, I think, very important to highlight the fact that a lot of the factors that contributed to the performance of the Fang Man companies is eroding. They're competing with each other for market share, and the group of eight companies is now trending downwards relative to the wider market. So the lesson is clear here that if one wants to outperform the wider market, all you have to do is not own those eight companies, and everything else will be fine. I do, however, think that out of them all, Facebook is exceptionally oversold, and a lot of the bad news is probably already in. But Apple, in particular, has quite a ways to go on the downside, and I would hesitate to buy one of their vehicles when it does come out. I do, however, think that lots of other people will buy them. Of course, I also hesitate to buy a Tesla because I just worry about the service network. And I worry about the technology, and I've heard too many bad news stories about them leaking. And by leaking, I mean water and rainwater coming into the footwell. And that's, of course, before you even begin to think about lithium batteries going on fire. Well, when we think about historic oversold conditions, well, the Hang Seng on a monthly basis has come out of an exceptionally deep oversold condition and coming back above 30 on the RSI. And we have to go back and look at an awful lot of history before we see a time when the RSI has been this oversold. So this isn't a lead indicator, it's a coincident move, and we can definitely see here that the Hang Seng is way oversold, so it has plenty of room in which to rebound. But then, of course, the big question is how far can that rebound go? One thing that we did see in here this week was that the property market in China. When we look at the I do apologize, I never seem to successfully remember this ticker. But when the property market has been down so heavily and is now starting to attract interest, because the government announced yesterday that they're going to spend approximately $937 billion on supporting the market. So those US dollar bonds are beginning to rebound. The reason, of course, that they are committing this kind of loan support to the property sector, and not just the state-owned sector, but the private property sector as well, is because there's over $2 trillion of debt that needs to be refinanced by local governments within the next 12 months, or 12 to 18 months. So that means that what China needs to do, as a matter of urgency, is to revitalize the demand for properties and kickstart the sales once more. Well, supporting property markets is a multi-pronged approach. So the first thing they're doing is they're ensuring that the property companies won't go bust. They're then providing loan guarantees in the order of about $1 trillion. And that should help those projects that have been on hold for most of the last 3 years to go ahead again. And a lot of those people who've been protesting about having paid the full price of a house that is never getting built, well, those people will, might actually get their houses. But by far the most important thing is that they restart the, I guess, the daisy chain of events that helps to support local government finances. There is no property tax in China, so local governments don't have a ready source of funds rather from anywhere other than the central government. So what they've relied on is land sales. They sell the land, property developers buy it. The property developers get the money to buy it from the local or from local banks and state banks as well. Then when they start paying that money back, well, they first have to give that money to the local government to buy the land. Then the local government will deposit that money in the bank. So it's a virtuous circle that allows money to move around the system and move from one party to the other, but it gives the local governments the money they need to meet their budgets. And that just doesn't work if you don't have property transactions. So China absolutely needs to support the property market. This is something that local investors have understood for a long time. That's why local investors tend to think that it doesn't really matter what they say in Beijing, but rather that eventually they'll have to support the property market because the entire economy relies on it. Now, of course, we also are, I think, fully aware that China's growth was very much predicated on leverage for most of the last 8 years. So that's a very significant change. And it means that China is now in the leverage game, just like everywhere else. Now, the way that it happens and the volume, or I guess the way that it happens is different, but the volumes are pretty similar. We're talking about trillions being thrown around here. But China starting to support the property market is certainly positive. And it means that there is a new source of liquidity on the global front. So this is, I think, very important because we are starting to see new sources of liquidity coming through. And this brings us to, I think, by far the most significant question. What happens when we do go into a recession? And will we see interest rates coming all the way back down? Or will they find support at a higher level? And then subsequently, are we going to see the size of central bank balance sheets multiply? If we do see the size of central bank balance sheets multiply, well, then we're going to go back into a really significant asset price-led boom. On the other hand, if we do not see the same quantity of monetary accommodation, and we see interest rates troughing well above where the lows were previously, then I suspect that we will have less of a big boom. So then, of course, the question is going to be about how pressing are these inflationary pressures? The one thing we do know is that the cost of servicing the debt has jumped over the last year. The bond yield is way up, and this is a totally global phenomenon. So, 10-year yields are still hovering here around 2.67%. They steadied a bit in the beginning of the week and finished closer to the lower side of the short-term range. But this continues to look like the break of a major uptrend. And one thing that is to be expected is when the size of the Fed's balance sheet contracts, then it's reasonable to anticipate that bond yields go up first. And they go up first because investors worry that the central bank is going to crowd out the rest of the market. And then eventually, what people start to worry about instead is deflationary forces and the downward pressure that all that tightening monetary and fiscal policy is having on the wider economy. So you generally tend to see yields go up first and then collapse. And well, we know that the Fed's balance sheet started to contract about 6 months ago. And the pace with which it is now accelerating lower is picking up. And a good part of the reason for that is because of TIPS yields. We're not seeing nearly the same moves higher in the principal for TIPS because bond yields are starting to moderate and inflationary pressures are also likely to moderate. And if the principal on the TIP yield isn't advancing, or instead it's contracting, well, then that is exaggerating the quantitative tightening program as it's going onwards. So that means the size of the balance sheet tends to go down faster. Now, let's also then pay attention to the size of the global central bank balance sheet, because it had been contracting for most of this year, and mostly because the Federal Reserve was raising rates, but the dollar was so strong. So, when we think about this index, it shaved over 4 trillion out of the total, and now it's beginning to steady. Well, if it starts to rise, it would imply that the weaker dollar is providing additional liquidity, and it's now starting to look increasingly likely that the Federal Reserve will stop raising rates at some point in the middle of next year. And I suspect that they're going to get rates up to about 5 or 5.25%, and then they're going to hang around and wait to see what happens. And usually, what happens is you get a recession. So then, of course, bond yields will come back down. So I think that one of the clearest trends that we can identify is that we're going to see yields collapse. And that's certainly going to be true of the shorter end of the curve. At the longer end of the curve, they'll go down even faster because the bond yields at the long end have risen really quite acutely. And they are way more sensitive to the inflation outlook. So I suspect that it's the long end of the curve is going to fall faster. And then that's also going to remove one of the big headwinds from the stock market. So when we think about the stock market, I don't think that the US market is going to be nearly as attractive over the course of the next few years than other markets. So the S&P 500 closed out the week in right in the region of the 200-day moving average. Hasn't quite yet been able to push up through it, and that might take a little while yet. We're seeing more liquidity being provided, and I think the focus of where that money is going to go will be outside the USA. So US growth is likely to contract before very long, and that would suggest that we'll be in a recession by the end of next year. At the moment, people are saying that there's a recession. They feel like there's a recession, but there's not a lot of evidence to suggest that there is a recession. One thing that we are starting to see, though, is that the purchasing managers' indices are trending lower. So the S&P version came out last week, or this week, I should say, and it was in negative territory. It was below 50, and the ISM is from the Michigan University is coming out right at the beginning of December, and I think that's the one that most people pay attention to. But it's likely that we're going to see manufacturing activity contracting. The reality is that we have inverted yield curves. Let me see if I can pull that up. So the 10-year minus the 2-year is now at negative 77.5 basis points. So we are now at a level of inversion that hasn't been seen since the early 1980s. And that was the peak of the last interest rate cycle. I would say that I don't like shooting from the hip, but I think it is more likely than not that the different shape to the yield curve spread that we have now compared to what prevailed between 1989 and 2020 would suggest that when they do begin to cut interest rates, they're not going to go back to zero. Instead, I think they'll probably stop around 1 or 2%. And then, if inflation doesn't moderate significantly, they'll be much more cautious and will start raising rates faster the next time around. And that would be copper fastening the view that we are now moving into a more of a tighter liquidity and inflationary environment overall. Well, gold prices have popped on the upside over the last week. Now they're pausing right now in the region of the 200-day moving average, but this does just look like a consolidation. Now let's flip it around and just look at the US dollar. So countries like the UK, or regions like the EU or Japan, well, they don't particularly want to have strong currencies. But they don't want the worst currencies in the world either. So it does look likely that they're going to eventually have some action to detract from their currency weakness, or their currency strength, I should say, but not right away. So the big question for them has been energy prices. Now we're starting to see energy rolling over. We're seeing the dollar coming down. So that has lent a really significant tailwind to currencies like the pound and the yen. So the pound is finishing out the week above 120. And that's a really significant move, considering that most people were worried about parity not all that long ago. And now we're in excess of 120. Well, it suggests that there is certainly going to be money moving into these other regions. And the huge debt that's been built up in the USA is going to come back to haunt it. There's $550 billion a year that needs to be paid in interest expense. So that dwarfs just about every other one of the spending departments aside from Medicare and the military. How, or I guess when, are we going to get the fiscal cohesion coming through from the USA? Well, since the two parties don't like talking with one another, the more likely scenario is that they're going to force a government shutdown. And that, I think, is looking quite likely. The other, I think, more important point to pay attention to here is that the rail workers union in the USA, well, they agreed not to go on strike before the election, and that was viewed as a favor that was done to the Democratic Party. But several of those unions have decided that they're going to reject the offer that's on the table. So it's increasing the potential that there is going to be a supply chain issue on the East Coast of America because some of those rail workers are going to go on strike. So That's not great for the dollar. It's something that's going to exacerbate inflationary pressures. But is that really the are we going to see a strong dollar as a response to that? I think it's really quite unlikely. And then let's think about the European stock markets. So the FTSE 250 has a PE of around 10 and a yield of about 3.5. And the index is or has rebounded in a reasonably impressive manner, and it's firming now in the region of the 200-day moving average. Well, if we see it pushing up through this level, well, then we have to conclude that the downtrend that's been in place really since October of last year is in fact over. I think it's also particularly relevant right now that we're seeing a significant number of banking indices looking up. That has certainly been true of the Eurozone and also Australia's banks. And UK banks are also firming from the lower side of the range that's been forming for this year. Well, banks are liquidity providers. If they're doing better, then it suggests that there's more opportunities for credit growth. And obviously, there's a lot of building that is taking place in Europe right now because a number of countries are worried about deflation coming through as a result of everything that's been going on. Well, if we get less inflation, but interest rates don't come down as much, well, then that's going to be positive for banks. If governments want to build their way out of this deflationary forces, or they want to build their way out of the energy crisis, well, then there's going to have to be demand for credit. There are going to have to be banks will be either voluntarily lend for infrastructure projects, or they're going to be told where to put that money. So it's, I think, a very strong commonality that a large number of global banking sectors are now starting to turn higher. So this is, I think, rather significant. And it does give us a picture of what we can anticipate from the global market as we come out of this recession. Now, considering the fact that the recession is only just starting, and central banks haven't even begun to talk about lowering interest rates yet, we're still in very early days. But certainly, banks doing better is a confidence-inducing measure. And then let's think about the S&P 500 banks. The one thing that I think is most especially important is that the U.S. banking sector isn't really a big mortgage lender. They basically outsourced the mortgage sector to private investors and to dedicated mortgage providers like Rocket Companies. And the mortgage providers are looking or doing exactly what one would anticipate from rising interest rates and a fall off in demand for mortgages and trending downwards. But in very clear terms, this is very different from the environment for banks that we had in 2008. What we're seeing now is more demand for infrastructure and more fee income and much tighter lending standards. Well, a lot of those mortgage companies, they're not the dominant forces in the property market and or in the financial markets any longer, even though they dominate the property market. So we can certainly have banks doing better, and mostly because the domestic property sector, at least in the USA, isn't nearly as prevalent in their earnings as it was previously. Of course, in Australia, bank loans are a big part of the domestic market, but Australia is still in an environment where the price of coal, natural gas, and oil is still really quite high, and Then let's just put these things together. So we have banks that are doing well, and on the back of the anticipation that there will be increased demand for credit. We then have the resources type companies, so the builders of heavy machinery and earth moving equipment like Caterpillar and Deere are really very strong. Then we can think about the kind of more industrial companies that build machines that go into factories. And so Honeywell continues to extend its breakout. Companies like Siemens have really been through a lengthy period of underperformance, but now also rebounding in a really emphatic fashion. So again, it's the kind of companies that are building the big machines that go inside factories, or they build the machines that go into big utilities. And GE is also starting to rebound in here and coming up off the lower side of this base that's been forming for the last 4 years. So there's a common theme here that there will be more infrastructure development. There will be more business for banks. And you can decide how you want to look at this infrastructure build, really any way you want. So on the one hand, the people who are really interested in the green movement, well, they'll say that there's got to be infrastructure development because we need to reduce carbon emissions. We need to create an environment where the earth is protected from our self-destruction, and that we absolutely need to do whatever is necessary to reduce global warming. Now, we could have an argument that would practically be indefinite in terms of the rationale behind that. But one thing is that the people who believe it are very keen on building infrastructure. Then you can have the other side of the argument. You can say, well, it doesn't matter what we do. The climate's going to warm anyway, so we really should be building bulwarks against rising tides. We should be building seawalls. We should be deepening rivers. We should be building out infrastructure. Everything from just drip-fed irrigation all the way through to harvesting water in any way possible. So that's massive new infrastructure. If we're then talking about the fact that we need to go green with EVs, well, we have this, what I still consider a logical inconsistency, that we are going to see a huge move in copper. And I do realize that that is not the copper price. So everybody who's very keen on electric vehicles realizes that the production of copper needs to double by 2030, which is only 7 years away, if we're going to even come close to meeting the demand growth forecasts necessary to reach the goals of reducing carbon emissions by one and a bit, or limiting the rise in temperatures to 1.5 degrees. And that's happening against a background where nobody wants to build a new copper mine. So the price is now back around the 363 level. And China has just announced the $1 trillion in support for the property sector. Well, that's positive for copper, but it didn't rally this week. So the rising and the continuing spread of COVID in China is going to continue to act as a headwind. But eventually, China is going to get to the same place with the pandemic as the rest of the world, which is that anyone who's going to get it will have got it. And anyone who was going to die from it would have died. And then they'll get on with their lives the same way that everyone else has. And that's obviously it's not a nice way to talk about it, but it is the reality. Then we'll see greater investment. There'll be then so that's there's three ways of talking about this infrastructure, but then I think the fourth is probably the most important, which is that we have geopolitical tensions. And the war in Ukraine, in very simple terms, highlighted the fact that you can't rely on a volatile neighbor to supply you with 40% of your energy and expect it to last indefinitely. The whole, the very definition of volatile implies that it's going to blow up eventually. And this year, the relationship between Russia and Europe blew up, and it is not going to go back to normal anytime soon. Germany is building natural gas import terminals. Their first floating regasification unit arrived in here this week. And Ukraine is going to take decades to rebuild. And all of the Cold War era arsenals that are being donated to Ukraine, where there was, for example, a swap agreement between Ukraine, Slovakia, and Germany, that Slovakia agreed to give Ukraine its Cold War era tanks in return to be resupplied by Germany with brand new tanks. So, what we are really seeing in Ukraine is an inventory change, that all of that old inventory that was rotting or rusting away is now being sent off to Ukraine to be destroyed. And the news has quieted down over the course of the last month because we're heading into winter and Eastern Europe gets really cold. So it would be very unusual for the war to get hot again until we get anywhere close to about 6 weeks before the thaw. And we can see that there will be volatility in the markets between now and then, because there'll be some people willing to bet that hostilities will not emerge again after winter. But all of these arguments are going to require massive spending on infrastructure. So when we start to think about what's likely, well, I don't think that global copper supply is going to double by 2030. But will it go up a bit? It will. And will there be more money invested in new mining? I think so, yes. And are we going to still be in a tight environment by the time we get out to 2030? I think that's also very likely. But are we also still moving into a recession? Yes. Will we have volatility on stock markets in 2023? I believe so. I think that we also should pay attention to the fact that the inversion of the 10-year minus the 3-month, it generally follows a similar pattern. And usually it's when it first becomes inverted, stock prices rally. And that is exactly what is happening now. It is only when the yield curve starts to turn back upwards and move up through zero and rising to as high as it's going to go, that's when we see the biggest selling pressure in stock markets. So we're not really yet at the end of all this. We're currently seeing a short-term bounce, and this short-term bounce could go a bit further, and the prayers of institutional investors could yet be answered, and it could carry on all the way through to the end of the year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is only now down 5.5%. So we've had a very meaningful rebound. And I will, I suppose, certainly concede the point that most of those companies are not industrial any longer. But this has been a really powerful bull market rebound. And we're now back into the region of 35,000. It has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. So we're certainly seeing more risk appetite coming into this market. And I think a lot of it has to do with the declining dollar. So the dollar going down is positive for gold. And gold prices are finding support now in the region of the peak from October and have broken the 7-month downtrend. So this is looking increasingly like a failed downside break. And if it pushes up through $1,800, and most particularly in a dynamic manner, that would confirm the failed downside break and enhance the scope for a retest of the peaks up there around 2,100. And on this occasion, we might yet see prices pushing on to sustainable new all-time highs. And I think that it is reasonable to anticipate that when we see the gold price breaking out again, then it's going to take out the all-time peak, but not only in nominal terms, but that it will also take out the peak in real terms. So when we look at gold adjusted for purchasing power parity, then it got all the way up to test the all-time peak from back in 1980, right in 2020 and in 2022. Now let me see if I can get this all the way back on a daily chart. We'll see then that on the daily chart, all of that intraday volatility in the 1980s is incorporated. So we can see that just for a couple of days in 1979, 1980, the currency or the purchasing power parity adjusted price got all the way up to test the $375 area. And on purchasing power parity basis, right now we're at 196. So gold, I believe, when it does go on this occasion, and the most important thing about gold is that when it goes, it can really go. But I would not be at all surprised that before the end of this new bull market, that gold will exceed the purchasing power parity peak from back in 1980. And that would suggest that prices are going to almost double from where they are right now. And of course, that implies that the dollar has a long way to go on the downside, that we are going to see a monetary response. I don't know if that monetary response is going to be quite as strong this time as it has in the past. But I think that this new bull market is going to be more about infrastructure, and that it is perhaps infrastructure spending will be the defining characteristic of the government response, that we will not see the fiscal transfers to the general population on this occasion, but we'll have state-sponsored infrastructure projects. And that's certainly what we're starting to see in terms of the commonality of the wider market, that these industrial and just companies that deal in big, solid stuff are doing really very well. Silver prices have also posted a failed downside break. And then when we look at the gold miners, they had pulled back and really been disappointing for most of this year, but they are steadying, and this looks like the completion of a 3-month base formation. So we're back up around the 2850 level. Then let's think about Bitcoin. More than any other asset, Bitcoin is dependent on liquidity. So the price is pretty stable right now, around $16,500. And then let's think about what would really be required to for Bitcoin to do what it has done in the past. We'd need to see the size of the Fed's balance sheet more than double. Now, it is not unheard of because these kinds of events have happened twice in the USA and also in the EU. If the size of the Fed's balance sheet doubles, well, then I would anticipate that Bitcoin could go on a 10x move. But if we do not see that quantity of money being printed, then Bitcoin will not take out its peak. So obviously it's an exceptionally volatile market, and of course those are both two bullish forecasts. But the other point is that the halving is going to be in April of 24, and we would anticipate that the price should bottom before the halvening and then rally after the halvening. So it would be reasonable to anticipate that in the first 6 months of next year, we will probably see a low for Bitcoin. Could that low be closer to 10,000 than 16,000? Absolutely. But the closer we get to the halvening, the more likely it is that the limited supply attributes of the asset will be burnished. So if gold starts doing better and the infrastructure bets that are starting to manifest become more pressing around the world, and the dollar goes down, and there's less focus on the technology sector, well, then that would suggest also that international markets will do better than the USA. And the Indian market in particular stands to benefit. I think there's lots of different arguments, but perhaps the most important is that India is still buying oil from Russia, and nobody is saying one thing about it because the rest of the world needs India and needs them badly to act as a bulwark against Chinese expansion in Asia. They need India to act as a manufacturing hub and to deploy that 600 million people younger than 25 years old. And they want India to be both a consumer market and then also to provide export goods for the rest of the world at a cheap price. The entire future of globalization rests on the Indian subcontinent, and the Nifty index is still firming from the 18,000 level. The other country that could seriously benefit from reshoring, or I guess perhaps more accurately, nearshoring, would be Mexico. And it has an eerily similar pattern to many of those industrial companies. So the nationalization of Mexico's lithium and the fact that they are now trying to encourage battery manufacturers. They want to start building batteries to build the electric vehicles that the USA is going to buy. And that sounds to me like a really sound business plan. They've also signed long-term contracts with Germany to build LNG export facilities. So there are a couple of different attributes that are going to be attractive for Mexico, on top of the fact that it has a land border and a free trade agreement with the USA to the north. We're certainly in very interesting times. The seeds of what look like new bull markets are starting to be formed, and we're still not quite there in terms of the anticipated recession. There will be an earnings shock at some point in the first half of next year. You cannot simply raise rates by 300 basis points and think that nothing is going to happen. And then it is when we start to see liquidity coming down, deflationary forces overwhelming inflation, and central banks worrying that they might have gone too far. That is when we'll see the major recovery that everyone has so dearly hoped for this year. Then I think that we're going to see bond yields coming down, potentially halving. I don't think that bond yields are going to come all the way back down to where they were during the pandemic, and that we'll see a big higher reaction low in those yields. But for the moment, people are looking at what's available in the bond market and thinking of those as attractive yields, and that is sucking liquidity out of the most, I guess, the liquidity prone portion of the market. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today and the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.